Today we're going to talk about some work I've been doing with Eugene, who's here and talked earlier, and Richard Easter. So inflation zero order is, of course, very, very successful. I mean, it's designed to be successful. I don't really need to tell you guys about this. Solves the rise and monopole flatness entropy problems. And along the ride come the quantum fluctuations, which we think seeded the structure of the CMBs and galaxies and whatnot. Unfortunately, and I just wipe it here, computation is just not unique. I mean, there's many, many ways that we've seen, like D-brains, DBI, of getting an inflationary scenario. And most of these predict an almost scale invariant spectrum of Gaussian fluctuations. It's just basically generic. So at lowest order in field theory language, we think of the power spectrum, or the two-point function, as basically like the propagator. And we think of this to be generated by quantum mechanical fluctuations of the inflaton around its trajectory during inflation. And as of the last sort of 10 years, we've got very good constraints on the shape and amplitude of this guy from the CMB data. However, gravity couples to everything, as we all know. So beyond lowest order, the modes will couple and, of course, evolve nonlinearly. And we've had a lot of talks on this. So diagrammatically, we can think about it like this. In the 1980s, people just were really concerned about the propagator itself, just the two-point function. In the 1990s, and I guess Maldesena revolutionized the field in 2002, thinking about the bispectrum. And then people like Martin Sloth and David Seri and Jim Libsey started thinking about the trispectrum, I guess, in 2006. And around the same time, people started thinking about loops, loop corrections to the propagator and consistency relations on this. And Martin Sloth talked about IR corrections, the IR problems associated with this morning. This is not really what I'm going to talk about today. And of course, we can just keep going. And this is quite an industry to calculate basically lots and lots of things. So what I'm going to talk about today, in the second part of the talk at least, is these two diagrams. So we've heard a lot of talks on this in informalism, and no one's really talked a lot about it. So I'm going to give a sort of general overview. I know most of you know a lot more about this than me, so hopefully we'll be able to go through that pretty quick. And then the second part of the talk, I'm going to talk about loop corrections in Enfeld inflation. And maybe this is the Hinchcliffe theorem again. Can we get bounds on N? And we'll see that we actually can't. And we'll be thinking about, well, in inflation at least, we can't come up with any bounds on N. And essentially what's happening is that we have a coherent field description to one loop order, which is quite interesting. And then I'll conclude. I think I'm going to run under time, so feel free to ask me questions at any point.
Function loop corrections. Yes. People certainly worked on it before 90s.
Right, yeah. Sure, I mean, I guess in this formalism, so. Right, yeah. Okay, so AD formalism, we heard a talk from Alberto this morning who mentioned this briefly, so let me mention it again. I won't spend too long on it. So the AD metric, we parameterize by a shift on the lattice, sorry, a shift vector, this Ni here, and a lattice, of course, N, and a spatial metric. The nice thing about this is that these enter the action as Lagrange multipliers. And of course, there's a big gauge freedom of GR. So not all choices of these lead to unique field configurations, of course. So in specifying a gauge in GR amounts to specifying a spatial slicing in something like a threading. And in most of this talk, I'll be talking about spatially flat gauge. So of course, the ADM action. Now, looks like this. This is just the Ricci scalar on the spatial slice. And this is what you think of as what's proportional to the extrinsic curvature, but it turns out to be like a gravitational momentum. And this pi is, of course, the field momentum. What's nice about this picture is that what I said earlier is that in the lattice and the shift have no dynamics. They don't propagate. What these are just simply constraints on the system. So once you know that, you can just put them back in the action. And you get an action that just contains dynamic degrees of freedom. So this is the ADM picture of GR. We've known about it since the late 60s, of course. I don't know what this
in this now? All right, so we had informalism. So we want to calculate correlation functions of these quantum fluctuations of fields. It differs in a couple of ways from usual QFT. We're not really interested in Nernst matrix. We don't really care about transition amplitudes, but we're interested in things like expectation values of the fields at fixed times. So, and also conditions, we only impose conditions at very early times, so we don't really have in states. And if you like, we integrate out, we integrate over all the out states. And there's two ways, really, or there's many ways of formulating this. You can formulate as a path integral, and this is something followed by Rich Holman and David Seri, like this way of doing things, or you can use operators. And what I'm going to talk about today is an operator formalism, which I think it's a really nice way of doing it, but obviously it's a matter of taste. And so the setup is this. We expand the action and the powers of the fluctuations, and in the gauge I'm working in, the dynamical variables are, of course, the fluctuations in metric and the fluctuations in the scalar field. And we, of course, discard the zeroth and first order pieces, because that just defines the background. Then we proceed in the usual way and quantize the system, defining canonical momentum and constructing the Hamiltonian. And then, of course, we work in the interaction picture. This is just like interaction picture quantum mechanics. You have a quadratic Hamiltonian, which you use to evolve the fields, and a higher order piece, the interaction Hamiltonian, which you use to generate interactions between this. So the lowest order piece, the piece that drives the fields, is quadratic. Interactions with your fields are just free fields, and so we can expand them in the usual mode expansion. The mode functions are just solutions of the usual equation of motion, Mooncanopsis Lackey equation, I think it's called. And most of this work in the De Sitter limit, where we take epsilon and, of course, the mass to be zero. We're really interested in how these modes interact, and these modes, of course, interact with terms, interactions that are proportional to slow roll. All right, so one thing that's a little bit weird about quantizing these theories is that we generically have time derivatives appearing in the interactions. And so this requires a little bit of care, because you can't simply do the usual thing where you find the interaction Hamiltonian is just simply the interaction part of the Lagrangian with the opposite sign. Of course, when you define your canonical momenta, you actually pick up these corrections. And it turns out in slow roll inflation, at least, these corrections to the canonical sort of what you expect the momenta to be are proportional to slow roll parameters or higher order parts of fluctuations. So at least the lowest order, we don't need to worry about this. But if you're doing something like DDI, this suppression is not necessarily small, so you can actually pick up things that you might care about. And so you have to be very careful. You just have to make sure you know what you're doing. Of course, correlation functions then, this just simply looks like something you do in time-dependent quantum mechanics. This is just the time evolution operator, this is just the Dyson solution, and this is just any product of operators constructed out of interaction picture fields. And there's really, really nothing mysterious about this. I mean, you can just insert a complete set of states, and then you can move this guy over to here, and it just looks like transition amplitudes. I mean, then it's just usual quantum field theory. And then you can think about like something like an endpoint function is just simply the sum of ways of obtaining a final state with n particles. Alternatively, you can think about this as a closed time path. You can think about evolving this state from here, evolving all the way up to some time t star, and then back to the vacuum again here. And then, of course, something like a second order interaction, just the amount of ways you can think about putting an interaction on these time paths, and it's just a sum over that. So, to calculate, rather than inserting states explicitly, it proves much, much easier just to use the Dyson solution. And then you can expand this guy order by order to find this. And the important point here is that time ordering has been taken care of. So you don't need to worry about time ordering of your propagators. or anything like that. Is this clear? Does everyone follow? Okay. So a tree level two-point correlation function is just simply this guy. Contraction of fields is just simply the usual thing. And so we can calculate these diagrams just using Whiting functions rather than just Feynman propagators, because they have no time dependence. Which theorem just follows in the usual way. And of course, in usual quantum field theory, we have this term on the bottom, which amounts to a phase factor, but of course, in unit formalism, it just cancels out. It's just one by unitarity. Okay. So there's a few minor subtleties associated with this. To calculate, you usually assume the infinite pass conditions in the adiabatic vacuum, although, of course, this isn't entirely necessary. And we've heard talks from Jan Peter, and I know Rich and Rich Holman thinks about an initial state where you don't have the vacuum. Computationally, the way you implement these initial state conditions is you deform your contours. You deform your initial time to give it some imaginary piece. And what this means is that this complex conjugation actually hits this, and so that your vertices arising from these two opposite sides are no longer equivalent, they just conjugate. They're conjugates to each other now. And there's two ways you can implement this. You can redefine your integrations to run over some complex integral rather than a real integral, or you can adequately continue your time variable to include some small imaginaries. Okay. So there's a few more subtleties. It's very tempting to write the expression in this way that makes it look much more symmetric, and indeed it puts all the second order effects on a similar footing. But the problem is that if you look at this at second order, you pick up this cross term. If you expand the previous correlation function out, you get a first order term from here, and a first order term from here, and get your second order piece, this term here. Which of course has this nice interpretation. You can think about it in terms of these transition amplitudes. And to write it in this way, you actually have to split this term up into these two half pieces. And then it's very, very tempting to then write this as, since this just simply looks like the complex conjugate of this, it's very tempting just to write this as the real part. But as shown earlier, actually the vacuum breaks this. And well, your initial state selection actually means that these are not conjugates of each other, so you can no longer just simply pick the real part and expect to get the right answer. You actually can run into some serious troubles.
You mean because of the I epsilons?
Yeah, right. So this here means that vertices from here and here.
Doesn't that mean that's just not a good way to define the
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure how else to implement it, right? I mean, is there another way of implementing it where you don't have this? I mean, you can derive this I epsilon correction to the time.
You can derive it if you're doing in out things.
Right.
As a justification, but I don't see why you would need to.
I think it's just an effect of taking this description too literally.
Pardon?
It's just an effect of taking it too literally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, another way of saying it is you've just got a set of three integrals, and
right.
There's a well-defined way to make sense in set of three integrals.
Okay, yeah, I know that. I mean, guess in a way, I made a sense of trying to, I mean, this.
But what stage do you switch from formal, especially trying to do the thing? So, I mean, formally that has to be correct, that it's the real part.
Right.
And then you have an integral, and then especially that makes sense.
Yeah, the problem is when you try and impose initial conditions on this thing, right? You can introduce singularities, I guess, is the point. You just have to go, okay. I mean,
the problem is just how to do the integral.
I mean, yeah, and perhaps it
wouldn't say it as initial conditions.
Okay.
You can if you want, though, right? Because you can derive the epsilon as being a vacuum wave function.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Right. Sure. But that for in out, that's straightforward.
Yeah. But
the subtlety here is you've got two bits, right? And then you.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, it's. I don't know. I think you can do it in the same way, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Because you can. I mean, you can. It's really just. I mean, it's. It's really just a product of two transition attitudes, right? There's nothing.
Yeah, I guess you can.
And I don't know. I mean, I think.
No, I agree.
But this, you can also just view it as a complex integral, and then you can do the big rotation.
Right.
Of
so
you
if you
in the way
is,
that gives you a finite.
If you view it as a complex integral, though, you still can't do this because you're going to have to complex conjugates your variables, right? So I really don't think. I mean, you have. I'm just saying you have to be very careful about how you treat this. I mean, you can. I mean, as I noted earlier, you can. I mean, there's two ways of doing it. I mean, well, there's two ways I can think of doing it.
Yeah, I agree. But these are mathematical subtleties, not.
Exactly, it's mathematical subtleties, and it comes from like trying to combine things that are coming from interactions here with things that are coming from interactions here. I mean, you may. I mean, I know Martin and Co. Sort of. We disagree about this, but I think you can make it quite rigorous if you put in the vacuum wave function.
Yeah, I guess you. Yeah.
Right, because then if you do it, your vacuum wave function, the sign flips on it, right? You pick up an imaginary piece and the sign flips and.
But you have to do one. You do one plus epsilon, one minus epsilon.
Right, exactly. And I guess my point is here. Is that these actually have opposite descriptions, right? So this is not really the conjugate of this, even though it looks like it.
Oh,
because one has the epsilon, you have to flip the prescription as well.
And basically your limits of integration on the two different terms aren't really the same limits.
Exactly.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So it looks like you can just do it, right?
Yeah.
It looks like okay, maybe.
So that these manipulations don't commute with the AI epsilon.
Yes, exactly. But I mean, is it the AI epsilon prescription? Can you choose your initial state in a different way so it doesn't matter? I mean, this is something I'm not sure about. I don't know. But anyway,
I mean, if you pretend that you're using the AI epsilon to try to pick up the adiabatic vacuum, right?
Right.
But suppose you don't. Suppose you have some initial density matrix that you're using,
sure.
And then don't worry about AI epsilon. And at the end of the day,
mm-hmm.
use a density matrix particulate a bunch of datas.
Right.
So then there's no ambiguity here.
Then you have to do it at finite time, and then.
Well, sure, but I mean, but then you can do it at finite time, and then take the time to go out to infinity.
Yeah, but still, you've got a symmetry thing. Still, you've got to somehow make sense. What's e to the ikt as t goes to infinity? That's the question.
It's true, but yeah, but if you look at the, I mean, if you look at the density matrix, you can pretend that you can sort of think regulated by being a thermal density matrix, for example, and take the temperature to go to zero. That's well behaved.
Yeah.
But there are ways to avoid this if you want.
Right. Okay. Sure. But I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that if you're going to just use this naive regularization to do the integral, right. I mean, if you don't want to write down the density matrix, for example, then you're going to have to. I mean, doing this. I mean, there are ways. I mean, you can. There are ways around it, but it's.
And you can. I mean, you can forget the I epsilon, and then you can just do the deformation of the complex contour, whatever you want.
For example, if you're calculating a two-point function, right, and you have to do things like calculate log shell from the start. You can't impose momentum conservation until the end of the calculation. And I think even.
So do you guys disagree in a way that gives a different answer?
No. We agree. We do agree. I think it's just that we just
get them to move on.
All right. Anyway, moving on. So I guess that's all I really want to say about this. There's really nothing mysterious about it. It's just ordinary QFT, and you just compute correlation functions with it. And I think, the operator formalisms are very fast, transparent ways of doing this. And there's only one contraction, and you just got to be careful with derivative couplings. And I really emphasize this. I think we should avoid this expression. I think it just results in more work and confusion. So, all right. So now we know about the NN formulas. I mean, I know this is probably kind of boring for most of you. Most of you know more about it than I do. So I want to talk about now sort of gravitationally induced loop corrections in n-field inflation. And what can we learn about the number of degrees of freedom from considering, you know, if we have a lot of degrees of freedom, of course, they can interact gravitationally and loop corrections may be out of control, and so on. So I'm going to consider two limits here. I'm going to consider an inflation scenario. We have n fields driving inflation. And then possibly the case, this is a case that Weinberg thought about, maybe we have other additional n-like fields with no energy density which don't contribute to the inflationary period. And I want to consider potentials which are uncoupled, and so the total potential is just the sum of all the other ones. And each potential, of course, just depending on a single scale field. And I guess the canonical example we have in mind here is just something like n squared, like n copies of n squared pi squared. And for the purposes of this work, we just are really worried about how things scale with n. So I'm going to consider somewhat unrealistically that they all have the same mass. So really, this is just n squared pi squared. So of course, the background equation of motion is just the Friedmann equation. The Hubble constant is just the sum of all the energy densities of the fields. And each field just obeys the homogeneous Klein-Gordon equation. And I think as Tolston mentioned, of course, each field fills a gradient of its own potential, but fills the Hubble friction of all fields. And I know this was a fairly contentious point the other day, that you can get inflation from Stieber potentials, where inflation may not occur individually, so I don't have a lot more to say than what was said earlier.
That's a perfectly valid statement. Cannot occur individually.
And of course, the slow roll parameter, the global slow roll parameter here is just the sum over all the other slow roll parameters. So this is what's controlling whether inflation can or cannot occur. This guy has to be small. So why might we care about n fields? I mean, why do we care about this? And of course, we know like the Tintac string theory had all these new degrees of freedom floating around. So if these can gravitationally couple to the inflaton, maybe they can create loop corrections that can get out of control. Alternatively, people like Lee have thought about inflation, infield inflation. It theoretically finds a way of realizing chaotic inflation consistently within an infective field theory. And of course, we know the problems with chaotic inflation is these problems of transplanckian waves. And so what happens in inflation is that the slow roll parameter gets essentially scaled down by a factor of n, and the field, the individual field, how far it moves, gets rescaled down by the square root of n. So it could provide a way of getting significant gravity waves while still respecting the life bound. We might not need, in a couple of years, we might not need significant gravity waves, so who knows? And I know Diwali's been working recently on maybe solving a hierarchy problem if you have as many as 10 to 32 couples in the standard model. So this number here is just more of like a ballpark of sort of the numbers, you know, like maybe you could get this huge n that could overcome all Planck mass suppressions and whatnot. So anyway, so that's a little bit of motivation behind why you might care. So
are you taking this into account? This is a naive question, because Bali's work basically deals with it in Planck, so it's scale with n as well.
Right. I mean, no. I didn't really want to say. I just put this here just for it. Yeah, I don't think it understands Bali's work at all. But. Right. I mean, the idea here is that Planck mass is so big because n is so big, right? That the effect of mass of the fields is m over n, or n Planck over root n or something. So anyway. So before we start, I mean, maybe we can try and estimate some simple bounds on n just from consistency relations, right? So we know that all massless fields, like the inflaton, fluctuate with an amplitude set of the Hubble scale. We know these fluctuations freeze out once you're outside the Hubble radius, and each one of these fields is going to contribute a bit of gradient energy given by this. So with the number of fields, the gradient energy is going to just scale like n times the Hubble factor over some constant. So if we compare this, so To be self-consistent, we need this to be much smaller than the diagonal part of Einstein's equations, right? So we compare this to the 0,0 Einstein equation, and we can come up with a bound that n must be much less than the Planck mass over h squared. The Planck mass squared, sorry, over h squared. And so if you have gut scale inflation, then of course n's got to be much less than 10 to the 6, things like that. This number, you can also derive this number in other contexts. I know there's some arguments from black hole holography that basically the number of states you can pack into a certain volume obey kind of similar things. So the question is, can we do any better than this, or can we make this more robust by considering gravitational sort of loop corrections from inflation?
Does this rule out the Wallace model?
Pardon?
Does this rule out the Wallace
model? I think he argues that it's in some different regime. I think he has some, he notes our work that sort of gets around it.
Sorry, doesn't this just mean that h squared is small compared to the cutoffs that the model would tell you you have there?
Yeah, yeah,
I think squared is Planck squared over x. So
right,
this is just consistent.
Yeah, I think this is. I think he's saying he's working in a different regime.
It's really is small. How small can number be?
Well, I mean, it could be TeV, right, or something like that. So this could be negative 32. Right.
If it's TeV, does it work?
If it's not only have to inflate the TeV.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you inflate the TeV, then n is 10 to the
3. Right.
That's right.
Then, yeah, 10 to the 19 over 10 to the 3, so 10 to the 16 squared. Okay. So how we do this calculation is before I get to there. So for this work, I guess I'm going to assume that the potential is completely under control. It's relatively stable. The slow roll parameters have all their loop corrections in them. I mean, maybe it's something like that. I don't know. Anyway, so what I want to think about now is the gravitationally induced loop corrections. And of course, as we've heard a lot about, the graviton couples to everything. So while loop corrections to the potential can maybe be thought of as reabsorbed into sort of radiative corrections to the slow roll parameters, what I want to think about is gravitationally induced loop corrections, which probably contribute radiative corrections to the power spectrum. And of course, if we have n degrees of freedom, it's possible that the loop corrections could scale with n or something. And because you've got these n degrees of freedom to run round and round the loops. Okay? So of course, density fluctuations in an inflation model look like this. This is just a two-point function of a fluctuation in the inflaton. And of course, we sum over all. And the one on n squared, I think, comes from the fact this is essentially something like a random walk. So the question I want to ask is, can bounds be put on n from loop corrections to the power spectrum? So first, you may expect that if you had n loops, you may expect the loop correction to scale like n to the n, for example, because you have n builds, n loops, n to the n. So at one loop order, you may expect something like this. So we may expect to find something similar to the gradient energy bound by requiring that the loops don't dominate the first order effects. So this is what we expect. So we're going to find it. So of course, there's some fairly, if you do these calculations, you end up with these fairly horrendous looking actions. And I believe the top one was something given by Malvasena. And this, of course, was calculated by, I think, Seri and Lipsy calculated this, the fourth order action. But what's important to note, and as Martin was mentioning earlier, the third order action is slow roll suppressed, whereas the fourth order action, of course, has no slow roll suppression in it. And I mean, we're working here at a medium order in slow roll, so there are, of course, more and more corrections here.
It was me who calculated the fourth order action.
Pardon?
I calculated.
Are you calculating this? Oh, I'm sorry. So Martin's lost calculation. And of course, I mean, this is just the medium order expression in slow roll, so. There's, of course, an epsilon times another term and eta and whatnot. And of course, there's pieces that we've dropped here because we just want to, I mean, we'll just start off the leading order scaling and see where it takes us. So, really, schematically, this is all we need to really care about for the purpose of this talk. The interactions look like this. We have a couple of fields that appeared inside this inverse Laplacian here, which is just understood in the usual way in the Fourier space, and another couple of fields that appear inside another one. And then the three-point interaction looks like this. We have some slow roll parameter coupled to one of the fields, and the other two fields appear. And then, of course, the an-in formalism tells us that the one with one vertex correction is just given by this, which, of course, looks familiar from calculating a non-Gaussianity. So for non-Gaussianity, you just have three fields here, and a third order action gives you the leading order non-Gaussianity. And, of course, the one with two vertex is given by this second order out of the So now you have two vertices, you have two copies of the interaction, and again here, to give you that. All right. So the dynamics we think about this, so we have an I-propagator being directed by NJ loops. Or we can have these two vertex one loop diagrams where we can have either this topology or this topology. So it's sort of important to note, these aren't really typical Feynman diagrams. They don't have a sense of time flowing through them. I mean, these are really only three momenta. And of course, there's a time integration associated with the vertex, but not necessarily the propagators themselves. They're useful for visualization, but I mean, you can construct Feynman rules for these, but I think they tend to be cumbersome, and I think it's just easier to calculate. All right. So since this guy is not slow roll suppressed, we kind of expect the biggest correction to this, to be from this value, right? There's no slow roll suppression. We can perhaps have something staying like n, these n other fields.
Excuse me. Yeah. I want to understand the third point. So time associated with vertices means that the two vertices can be at different times.
Yeah.
Right. And the only constraint is that the two external legs are at equal time.
Yeah. Right. So yeah. So these are fixed times, the time of observation, right? And then you integrate over all possible times that, and then with this case, sometimes this has to occur before this, but right. It's okay. All right. So as I said earlier, the biggest possible thing we might expect is for a J correction to an I propagator. And a contribution to this we want to find is our we can track together the I fields, and then this is the loop tractor here. And what's interesting to note here is that the loop is completely independent of the external momentum. So just like ordinary quantum field theory, this is just pure counter term, or you may resum it into a mass for the inflaton. So this guy doesn't contribute. So you may think, well, can any of the one with one vertex contribute? And the answer is yes. So, unlike a lambda phi to the fourth theory, you can actually sneak the external scale into the problem. If you instead of the interaction, let me skip back, look like this. So instead of contracting the external field, well, these two fields together, if you contract this field with this field, because of these inverse Laplacian structure, you can actually get this happening, and so you end up with the external scale here is now inside the loop. So this isn't pure counterterm, but the expense of doing this is that you now, basically this is just a self-interaction. So there's only one of these guys, there's no factor of n. You've lost your factor of n. So really, this guy doesn't do any better than the leading order scale. And this isn't really that hard to understand, right? These interactions here really they're really mediated by gravity. So they're really like two propagators which have something propagating between them. So you could write possibly think of working in a different gauge, and this interaction would probably look something like this. I mean, this is just schematic, and I'm not sure I could tell you what this gauge was. But so our diagrams earlier are just simply this, which is just a balloon diagram, which anyone knows that's zero, right? And then this one doesn't scale like n because the propagator just can't change species. I mean, gravitational exchange is not going to change the species for you. So this guy doesn't scale. So there's no factors of n there. What about the two vertex loop? So you can't sorry, in this case, you can't really be cheated out of this guy because the topology of it is such that the momentum has to flow through the loop.
So in the balloon case, you're saying there's no factor of n?
Right.
Why?
Well, there is a factor of n from this guy, right?
But am I?
But there's no enhancement from the number of degrees of freedom flowing around the loop, I guess is what I'm saying.
Why not?
It's scale free, right? It doesn't have the external scale of the problem.
Okay, yeah, you're saying the first is pure counter.
Yeah, it's pure counter. The second's not, but the propagator can't change species though, right?
Yes.
So they can't scale. Alright, so what about the two variables then? And I said you can't be cheated down this now because there's no way that the momentum cannot flow through there. You know, there's no way you can get a scale free integral from this. And if you do this calculation, it's fairly horrendous. There's six diagrams. You get this fairly nasty factor, which, I don't know. I don't like it, but it is what it is. So anyway, the thing to note here, right, is that this F1i is just simply the slow roll parameter of one of the loops. It's not the global slow roll parameter, which is this guy. So if both there's n of these loops, essentially the slow roll parameter eats up the n because you're describing it back. I mean, this is the slow roll parameter of one of the fields, but the thing that you actually observe is this guy. So there's no bounds from this loop either. All right, so what about more loops? So if we go to more loops, it's pretty easy to see that you can't get any more factors of n even from more loops. As I showed, the leading order 4-point is only non-zero for self interactions. Coupling in the 3-point secretly has this one on root n hidden in it. So any diagrams you construct out of these vertices really is not going to give you any more powers of n. And this, of course, must occur in pairs. Sorry. So you're going to get powers of 1 on n at higher order. And so yeah, you may think, well, you know, you've cut off at lower order and slower order. What happens if you go to higher order? And it's not too hard to see that even at higher order and slower order, in fact, all of us in slower order, you can't actually pick up any of these, anything that scales with n. And the reason is that the interactions in the action must appear as scalars with respect to the field instance. Perturbations can't generate, I mean, the action is a scalar, so it has to remain a scalar under perturbations. An important point here, I guess, is that we've assumed a flat target space. So the only way you can construct scalars here, well, aside from SON invariants or whatever, is if you pair fields either with themselves, with other fields, or you pair them with the background. And because this is inflation, or inflation of n fields, this really has a factor of n hidden inside it because, you know, this is the property of one of the fields, not of the global space-time, which is inflating. So an interaction like this, of course, which would scale like n cubed, is forbidden because this thing is not a scalar. Perhaps this is a way to understand what Martin was saying earlier, that you can't, you know, if you take the limit, I mean, if you work in with n fields and take the limit n goes to 1, you can't construct something that doesn't have a slow roll parameter in it with 3 fields. It's maybe don't like the argument, but I think it's kind of nice. All right, so you can't do any better than leading on the scaling. So inflation, there's no bounds on n from loops. So what about the other extreme? What happens if we now consider just usual inflation with a bunch of light scalar fields hanging out? So this is not my calculation. This is something that was considered by Steven Weinberg.
So can I just understand this, the fact that there's no independence because you have O-N symmetry? So you have cancellation. So if you just naively took one term, you say, oh, they're the independence, they cancel.
Right.
The original theory you extended around has an exact O-N symmetry.
Right, I think so. I mean, but I think you can break the O-N symmetry because I think you can break the O-N symmetry with the potential, right? But there's constraints on the couplings between the fields from the background itself. So you have to still break the symmetry and still get inflation.
This is just like, you know, and if like a field theory, you look at W scattering, you think you have something in the bin, there's actually cancellation.
Right.
Because there's a real hidden symmetry that's restored.
I think
if you break it softly, then you'll still have approximate cancellation. They won't cancel like that.
I think you'll still, I mean, you're none of these, so like V triple prime. I mean, I just think the constraints from the background itself will be stronger than the constraints you can get from this, right?
That's tough.
And
that's true, even if the loops, even if you're breaking completely.
Right, exactly.
It would be at the same order. So.
I think you're right. But I guess you're sort of introducing direct couplings rather than sort of gravitationally induced. And I think you'd have to do something more more severe, like I've assumed a diagonal target space, right? So if you assume some coupling between the kinetic terms, then you might be able to get some scaling. But then you may have problems where you could have a propagator, like a species problem, right? Where the propagator could change species. If you couple the kinetic terms together, for example. So I don't know,
can't you just work in a diagonal basis for everything?
Yeah, you probably could, I guess.
I don't understand. I mean, there's no cancellation between like n cubed. It's not there. That doesn't matter with O n symmetry or not.
Right. Well, no. It's not there.
I don't see where the cancellation.
It's not cancellation.
Yeah,
it's just not there.
That's right.
You can't
that's
write
right.
down the.
So you don't get O n symmetry. It's just not there.
But I think the O n symmetry is important because you may get it perturbatively if you have it. I mean, these are all basically coming from the kinetic part of the infraton action, right? Apologies. So I think you'd have to do something severe to the kinetic term, but this isn't something I've really thought about. But okay.
How about the running of the couplings in your theory?
I think that's also, I mean, so like you may have a Landau pole, right? But I think that this is also, it's also constrained quite severely by the background. Because if you remember, the reason you introduce these N fields is because basically all your couplings get scaled down, your field excursions get really scaled down. So I think you get around it that way.
It's not clear to me, though.
I think there's no problems with that. I think
so. You check.
Yeah, I check. I mean, you can write down the expression for the running of the coupling. For example, if you put lambda by 4 term in, you can look at the running of lambda, and you may expect that as you increase n, you get a lambda polarization, right? But I think the coupling itself has to scale down as you increase the number of fields.
About the running of the Planck mass.
The running of the Planck, that's something I haven't checked.
Okay.
But
that goes as n.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think it's an easy answer.
That's the main reason that the model refers to the end length model doesn't work because of that. So there's no control of that anyone has proposed.
Right. Okay. Sure. Okay. So what about the other case now? So this is something Weinberg looked at, so I'm not going to talk about it too much, but basically, yeah, you have the 4-point, of course, only generates one loop now for the same reason that you're just going to get scalar-free loops whenever you have these scalars in the loop itself, because it's just going to, I mean, it's gravitationally mediated, so it's being mediated by some graviton. And then the 3-point, it's like this, so if you do this calculation, in this case, you do get a scaling, right? The M scalars in the 2-point loop now contribute an amount like this. And you can get a bound, and this turns out to be weaker than the gradient energy bound by a factor of 1 on epsilon. So
does that include the 4-point?
So the 4-point is 0 for this, right? Because there's no way you can get a loop with a scale in it. I mean, it's the same argument that goes, you can think about, it's the same argument as before, basically. Is that this can't contract with this. This has to contract with itself. So you can't get any. You essentially end up with pure counter terms for these one loop, one vertex terms. That make sense?
Well,
we can talk about that later, maybe. So you come up with this bound. So you may be thinking now, well, I know that in the inflation, I can write my field as just one effect. There's only one effective degree of freedom. So I can basically think about this. I can write the radial field, and I can imagine this collective field rolling towards the center of the sphere, for example, in N space. And so if I look at the Lagrangian, it looks like this. And now it looks like we have one inflaton and a bunch of massless scalars. I mean, these scalars just now don't have a mass to them. So why don't we have Weinberg result here? I mean, what is going on? So the short answer, I guess, is that this isn't really quite the case of Weinberg. I mean, these are really defined on a compact space. So, and it's important point to note that the angle fields are actually very quickly damped for your attractor solution. So you may worry about loop correction. So now this action.
I guess it's an artifact of the fact that it shows an historical report, because you could say, given your inflationary trajectory, rotate rigidly your thin space in such a way as to align one axis to the trajectory, and all the others are perpendicular. And now you have Cartesian coordinates, it's not that spherical.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that there's a way of aligning these fields in.
How do you mean? Sorry, I'm not following.
I'm just like my life. So suppose you do it on the plane, okay?
Yeah.
So if you have two fields, okay, mm-hmm. and your trajectory is here,
mm-hmm.
what you're doing is select the radial coordinate and the angular coordinate.
Okay.
What I'm proposing is to choose this axis.
Okay.
In this case you have Cartesian fields and you don't have this complication of angular vectors. I would say you have exactly Weinberg's case.
Yeah, that's not something I haven't thought about. And maybe I'll talk about that later. It's not something I've really thought about, but I know you can. I mean, you can reason why you don't get Weinberg's case. If you think about it in spherical coordinates, it's not hard to see why you don't pick up Weinberg. I mean, essentially, this compact space allows you to pick up one, basically, have one non-zero angle, and then. So if you perturb around this, you may worry that these direct couplings here spoil things, because now you've got direct.
Sorry, how do you get the last term? I mean, so if you go to spherical coordinates, right?
Yeah.
You would have something a little bit more complicated than this.
So this is just taking the original. And so this is just defining.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is fine. I think you can define your angular coordinates like this, right?
Okay, I inside there will make it a sort of.
This is a vector. Sure. I mean, this is.
Yes.
Okay.
This is why I think still, sorry to turn, but it seems like just it's the O-N symmetry again. Right? Weinberg assumes.
This is O-N symmetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, assumes that
yeah.
it feels.
But I think it's the O-N symmetry of this guy. Right.
So Weinberg does not have that symmetry. So you cannot.
He does, though, right? I mean, he only assumes that. I don't think I have the action.
I mean, phi has a potential. So there's one direction which is preferred.
Right, but Weinberg has the same text.
That's
right?
Why he has O n minus 4 in the
symmetry.
The inflaton is different than the other.
Right, yeah, I think that's the key point here, is that you can show that this isn't exactly. These fields kind of know they're part of some coherent.
Right. In the Weinberg case, the minus 1 is driving inflation.
No.
Well, in the inflation case, n is driving inflation. So
it's the one.
Almost the same.
Right.
I think it's that. It almost looks like Weinberg, but the point is that the field somehow knows that it's part of this coherent sort of motion. Anyway, I mean, there's simple arguments why you can basically. You might worry that now you have these direct couplings that you've introduced, and why, you know, if you perturb about these, why don't these lead to loop corrections directly? And it's pretty easy to actually see why you can't get loops from any of these guys that contribute. Because the thing is very quickly damped, the attractor solution, so you can choose a particular direction and basically choose one angle. So this thing now only gives you at most one loop, right? Because only one of these is non-zero. So you've only got one interaction there. This guy, of course, by the arguments earlier, is scale-free, because you can't get the scales of the Q inside the W loop. And then, finally, I think for this guy, you can show that these omega-I fields very, very quickly redshift away. So basically you end up with integrals which are just proportional to tau, which goes to zero. So, all right. So, in summary, the gradient energy bound is actually the only bound we can, well, it's the strongest bound we can find, I guess, on the number of degrees of freedom. We found that one-loop quantum corrections don't provide any bound at all. In the inflation case, that is. And inflation looks like it can be recast as a coherent single scalar field with one effective degree of freedom, even up to one-loop level, so, which is quite interesting, I thought. On the other extreme, you can get a bound from just having n spectator fields hanging around, which is weaker than the gradient energy bound by the factor one and epsilon. So, and just like to thank Richard and Eugene, and also Rich and Martin for great conversation. So, any questions?
But people are still thinking. And, it's, and the bar is about to open, so it's coming through really well. Yeah.
All right.
So why don't you join me and thank you one more time, and then all the rest of the speakers today as well.